Similarly, in Luke and Ben's first meeting, Father Skywalker obviously knew he had a son and wished that he would one day be able to pass on to him his lightsaber. However, with his death at Vader's hands, it is Obi-Wan's duty to honor his friend's wish. Owen didn't want Luke to learn of the Force or to talk to Ben, not because Ben let his father become evil, but because Ben's persuasion to become a Jedi ended up causing Father Skywalker's death. This is the reason Luke's aunt and uncle are wary of Ben, despite the fact that the exchange, "He's got too much of his father in him, that's what I'm afraid of," pays off better with the retroactive change. These types of retroactive changes are common in complex and long-running series such as what Star Wars would eventually become, where the interpretation of previous tales is altered by information revealed in subsequent entries, and are known in fan communities as retcon, or retroactive continuity alterations. Often, retcons are simply the result of ongoing writing that is primarily made up on the go, desire on the part of the writer to keep things fresh for his or herself, and the demands of keeping an enraptured audience surprised with a previous continuity already established. Perhaps the best example of this method of ongoing writing is the most popular form of serial in the modern world, daytime soap operas. "I wasn't dead, it was really my twin brother. I'm really the baby's father. I shot JR," etc., where unexpected twists leave the audience tuning in next episode and keep the story fresh by constantly reinventing what has already preceded. The retroactive changes also make Kenobi into a lying manipulator instead of the truthful father figure he was supposed to be, while Vader becomes more humanized and less of a villain, an ongoing transformation that would occur in the following films. Similarly, the fact that Darth Vader's name is in fact Darth Vader, and not a rank, title, or alias, is reinforced when Kenobi finally meets him and calls him Darth, rather than Vader. "Ben, only a master of evil, Darth." And again, "Ben, you can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine." This is consistent with the earlier scene wherein Kenobi says, "a young Jedi named Darth Vader." Back in the days of the film's release, everyone referred to him as Darth, such as Carrie Fisher in the making of Star Wars 1977 television special, as it was obviously his first name. For a much more thorough examination of this point, see Appendix C. Lucas himself treated the character rather flippantly behind the scenes, referring to the above scene merely as the final battle between Ben and the Warlord in one production meeting with cameraman Gil Taylor, a perspective that is consistent with the lack of importance beyond the role of serial henchman Lucas grants the character in his private notes and conversations. In fact, in Rinsler's authoritative Making of Star Wars, Lucas barely even mentions the character, fitting since Vader has only a few scenes in the film. In addition, in the above-quoted scene, Vader says, "When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master." This, of course, is perfectly in keeping with what Obi-Wan tells Luke earlier. Darth was a student of his, who turned evil. However, Obi-Wan also says, "I was a Jedi Knight, the same as your father." Vader was only a student when he left Obi-Wan, a young Jedi, while Father Skywalker was close to Obi-Wan's age and was a full, experienced knight. If they are to be the same person, then there is direct contradiction here. Was he a young student, or was he an older Jedi Knight? As it stands, the viewer can now, in the saga viewpoint, contrive an explanation by reasoning that Vader was hyperbolizing his inexperience as a Jedi, and meaning to say that he is now wise and fully trained through the dark side, and that Kenobi was talking in general terms. It would now be pertinent to discuss the matter of whether or not Vader and Obi-Wan have met since Vader left him, as we will uncover that this is a pivotal plot point, but one that is actually nowhere hinted at or implied in the film itself. By the time Return of the Jedi was released, It was revealed that Ben fought Vader on a volcano and wounded him to such an extent that he required the mechanical suit to survive, having fallen into a fiery pit, so dubbed the Duel. Since Star Wars was written under a different context, with Vader and Father Skywalker separate characters, it is at first not clear if Lucas had the Duel in mind, and if he did, what was the form in which it occurred? Did Vader simply abandon Obi-Wan and begin hunting down the Jedi Knights? Or was there a conflict between them? The volcano duel is still viable, even with the original context of the characters in mind. Obi-Wan was not battling Father Skywalker because he turned to the dark side. He was battling Vader to avenge Father Skywalker's death. This is the story that would eventually be decided upon, to be explored shortly. Another possibility is that Vader came for Obi-Wan when the Jedi Purge began, but Obi-Wan fought him off and escaped. Lucas's comments in 1977 may point to this. Certainly, it appears the scene between them on the Death Star can be read either way. Vader says, "We meet again at last." Does this imply, "Finally we meet since I left you," or "Finally we will have a rematch"? Vader follows it up with, "When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master." However, this rematch interpretation is itself a giant leap that overlooks a simple but often ignored piece of investigative logic. Why are we even looking for hints of a previous encounter? What suggestion or evidence is there in the film itself to propose that such a history even exists? Without knowledge of the backstory to bias one's perspective of the scene, any reference to a prior conflict vanishes. There is nothing to imply that they have fought before. Kenobi says Vader simply abandoned his Jedi training, and when they meet again 20 years later, Vader says that the last time they were together he was a mere student and that he left him. Looking at the dialogue and attitudes of the characters, there doesn't seem to be any indication at all of a prior battle between them. And most significantly, Kenobi is silent to Luke about any sort of volcano duel between himself and Vader, which surely would have been relevant to Luke. The Death Star confrontation plays out as if it is the first time they have faced each other since Vader joined the dark side. The issue of Vader leaving Kenobi is a continuing development from Draft 3, where Vader takes Ben's kyber crystal. In that version, there wasn't any conflict indicated. Kenobi states that Darth merely took the crystal and joined the Sith. No former confrontation is ever implied between them, and perhaps a likely scenario is that Vader took the crystal behind Kenobi's back and never even had to face him, which seems to be a bit more in keeping with the character's backhanded treachery. This whole issue of leaving the Jedi was in turn a continuing development from Draft 2, where the history played out in a manner similar to this, and was attached to former Jedi Darklighter, whom Lucas explicitly states did not battle his mentor, but that he simply ran away from his instructor and taught the evil ways of the Boggan Force to a clan of Sith pirates. Lucas simply attached this to Vader for Draft 3, and it doesn't appear to have changed, nor in Draft 4. As well, in Draft 3, when this history is first attached to him, Vader's mask is not yet a permanent fixture. As mentioned before, in one scene it is removed and Vader is drinking from a flask. Vader's armored spacesuit might have only been worn for the opening boarding sequence, and perhaps the end space battle. With the rest of the film depicting him in some kind of imperial uniform, and of course his face uncovered and portrayed by whatever actor was cast in the role. Thus, he would not have been hideously scarred, and certainly not to the extent of having to be encased in a suit to hide his deformities, although, being a hardened warlord, it would be a reasonable act to give him a face blemished with some of the scars of battle. Lucas's notes for the second draft state that the Sith Knights have gruesome faces to symbolize their evil, like Linda Blair from The Exorcist, though Lucas may have relented on this with the more humanized Vader in Draft 3. It is not hard to picture all of Vader's scenes on board the Death Star, attending conferences and dueling Ben, as being visualized with a tall, grim, imperial general, much like he is described in the first draft. However, with the fourth draft, Lucas simply decided to use Macquarie's effectively frightening mask, a skull crossed with a wolf, as the physical personification of him, and, as will be examined shortly, this inadvertently ended up giving Vader a somewhat robotic aura. The fact that the final script and film never show Vader without the mask is purely coincidental, in the sense that it is not prompted by anything specific. For the sake of logic, it can be plausibly argued that Darth donned the fearsome suit and helmet upon his turn to the dark side and alliance with the Empire as a symbol of fear and intimidation, much like how stormtroopers adopt their suits as a permanent public image for these reasons. Lucas would implement a similar concept to this orthodox Vader in Willow, in the character of General Kale, a tall, grim-looking warlord who wears a skull mask for most, but not all, of the film. However, by the time Lucas got to actually shooting the film, he had in mind the concept of the duel, as he revealed to Mark Hamill on the set in 1976. However, it wasn't the immobilizing, near-fatal duel that would be later decided on, nor anything requiring medical encasement in an iron lung. Rather, Obi-Wan and Vader were to fight, and Vader loses the battle when he falls into some kind of volcanic pit. Vader emerges from the pit intact and alive, but he has been hideously scarred, so much so that he must wear a mask and full bodysuit to cover his disfiguring injuries, much like Dr. Doom. This was the initial significance of the duel. It would appear that the duel was invented after the fourth draft, after Darth had been written to kill Father Skywalker, as a means of both providing some resolution to that story thread by Kenobi's vengeance, as well as explaining why Vader wears the suit, which, because it is worn in every single scene, now came off as being a permanent encasement. This indicates the duel's genesis as probably being somewhere between January, when the initial fourth draft was written, and March, when filming commenced, whereupon the tale was related to Mark Hamill, though filming main unit did not end until July, and the revised fourth draft was being rewritten with major story revisions as late as the halfway point of production, so this time period is conservative as Hamill does not specify a date. The revised fourth draft, where the plot point of Vader killing Father Skywalker first appears, was itself written during this period. Mark Hamill recalled Lucas telling him the story of the duel. Hamill's version is somewhat unique, as it includes Obi-Wan and Father Skywalker battling Vader together, rather than Obi-Wan avenging Skywalker's murder afterwards, with Vader and Skywalker both falling into the volcanic pit simultaneously, as well as including additional details about the Emperor scaring Obi-Wan into the forest. Lucas would later tell that after the initial Jedi purge, Obi-Wan and Father Skywalker were the last Jedi left alive, with Vader personally hunting down the survivors. Perhaps he confronted them both on the site of a volcano, managing to kill Father Skywalker, but then was struck down by Kenobi. Other likely explanations are that Lucas told variations on the story since it was not yet set in stone, or simply that Hamill's memory is a bit foggy. Hamill said in 1980, "I remember very early on asking who my parents were, and being told that my father and Obi-Wan met Vader on the edge of a volcano and they had a duel. My father and Darth Vader fell into the crater and my father was instantly killed. Vader crawled out horribly scarred, and at that point the Emperor landed and Obi-Wan ran into the forest, never to be seen again." This disfiguration encasement would soon become a life support necessity. In his August 25, 1977 interview with Rolling Stone, George Lucas told this fascinating story, the first public reveal of the newly created backstory. "Why does Darth Vader breathe so heavily?
I had wanted to do that and tie it in with the dialogue. Ben Burtt had a lot of work in that, too. He did about 18 different kinds of breathing, through aqualungs and through tubes, trying to find the one that had the right sort of mechanical sound. and then decide whether it would be totally rhythmical and like an iron lung. That's the idea. It was a whole part of the plot that essentially got cut out. It may be in one of the sequels. It's about Ben and Luke's father and Vader when they are young Jedi Knights. But Vader kills Luke's father. Then Ben and Vader have a confrontation, just like they have in Star Wars, and Ben almost kills Vader. As a matter of fact, he falls into a volcanic pit and gets fried and is one destroyed being. That's why he has to wear the suit with a mask, because it's a breathing mask. It's like a walking iron lung. His face is all horrible inside. I was going to shoot a close-up of Vader where you could see the inside of his face, but then we said no, it would destroy the mystique of the whole thing.
In the interview with Rolling Stone, Lucas says he initially wanted breathing only over Vader's dialogue, as if his speech was merely filtered through the mask. But when Ben Burtt did the sound design, he came up with a constant rhythm, a cold mechanical sound like an iron lung. It was an aspect Ben Burtt added in post-production. When Lucas saw how robotic Vader looked in the suit with the rhythmic, cold mechanical breathing Burtt had created, he might have decided that perhaps Vader wore the suit as a form of life support, and that he was partially reassembled as a cyborg, which fit in perfectly with the continuity, since Lucas had already come up with the idea that Vader was hideously scarred by Kenobi. Thus, Vader might not have truly become mechanical until the final film, until the sound mix. Lucas had always been fond of the idea of someone having their battle-related injuries rehabilitated with mechanical parts. It appears in every draft except the final one. Now he had a chance to finally use it. In fact, after Lucas became excited by the idea, the walking iron lung concept was overzealously emphasized, as Burt tells, and was then reverted back to a simpler and less distracting breathing. Ben Burtt explained in a 1993 interview.
The original concept I had of Darth Vader was a very noise-producing individual. He came into the scene, he was breathing like some queasing windmill. You could hear his heart beating. He moved his head and you heard motors turning. And he was almost like some kind of a robot in some sense. And he made so much noise that we sort of had to cut back on that concept. In the first experimental mixes we did in Star Wars, he sounded like an operating room, you know, an emergency room, you know, moving around.
The first official mention of the duel in a Lucasfilm publication does not occur until late 1977, in the magazine Star Wars Poster Monthly. What is less well known is that Vader himself was then almost killed by Ben Kenobi, who was understandably enraged at his disciple's fall from grace. Vader's life might have ended then and there with a quick stab of a lightsaber. Instead, during the fight, Vader stumbled backwards and fell into a volcanic pit where he was nearly fried alive. What remained of his human body was dragged out and preserved by encasing it in an outsized black metal suit, virtually a walking iron lung. His face, now too horrible to behold, remains permanently hidden behind the sinister metal breath screen from which his red eyes glint unmercifully. Only his heavy, rasping breath reveals the suit's true function. Now that the iron lung version had been settled on, the above quote in turn emphasizes how badly Vader was hurt, seeing as his remains had to be dragged out and resuscitated, presumably by the Emperor, as Hamill implies in his less severe version of the tale. End point. With the completion of the revised fourth draft screenplay, the final script was tightly paced, always on the move, as Obi-Wan would put it, but now had the strength of strong characters to support the outlandish plot and design. From clever ironies like the damsel in distress grabbing the gun from her rescuers and shouting orders at them.
"I mean, they can't even rescue her,"
Lucas once said of his lovably clumsy characters, to outright comedy like Han's failed attempt at explaining the prison shootout to a radio dispatcher, to the touching sentimentality of Obi-Wan's self-sacrifice, the script had finally arrived as an engaging adventure film that would become a cinema classic. Remember, back in 1977,
A simple thing such as the cantina sequence was astonishingly original. In fact, people were blown away by Greedo's appearance, with his bizarre language and subtitled dialogue. Outrageous aliens drinking ale, getting into bar brawls, and listening to swing music. Nothing so imaginative and unique had ever been attempted in a film before. Today, it seems almost a pedestrian concept, but back then, it was absolute genius. Something never before put on a movie screen. And the scene finishes as if it were written by Sergio Leone. "Cowboys in space," Lucas had once said. He gave us so much more. Lucas recollected writing the film in a candid 1977 interview with French magazine Écran, revealing how fluid and collaborative the undertaking truly was.
"It took me about 3 years to write the screenplay. I wrote four versions, meaning four completely different plots, before finding the one that satisfied me. It was really difficult because I didn't want Star Wars to be a typical science fiction. I wanted it to be a truly imaginative film. I had some good ideas in the first version, but no solid storyline, which is a challenge for me because I hate plots. The difficulty was managing to find an overarching theme."
"You wrote the screenplay all by yourself?"
"Yeah, it's terrible. It's painful, atrocious."
"You didn't work with screenwriters?"
"At the end, I had some friends come to England to do some last-minute rewriting when we were just about to shoot."
"But before that, you didn't discuss it with anyone?"
"Well, yeah. We're all one group of friends here. Francis Coppola, Matt Robbins, Bill Hyken, Gloria Katz, and a friend I went to school with who works in my production office here. We're all screenwriters. We read each other's scripts and comment on them. I think this is the only way for us to keep from writing in a total void. I respect the opinions of these friends. Their comments are intelligent because they're into the same things as me. There are also those who, in addition to being screenwriters, are directors and friends of mine. Coppola, whom I've already mentioned, Phil Kaufman, Martin Scorsese, and Brian De Palma. I show them all of my footage, and they give me precious opinions that I count on. When you don't know people well, they either give you dishonest compliments or tell you how they would shoot it. And that's not what I'm asking them for. We serve as sounding boards to help at two crucial times in film creation: the first version of the script and the film editing. That's when you need a friend whom you have total confidence in to tell you, here you have to cut, there you have to do this. Often, these are obvious things, but often, too, there are sections that you've spent months on, that you've worked on so long you can't see them objectively anymore."
"Tell me a bit about how these discussions worked."
"I wrote the first version of Star Wars. We discussed it, and I realized I hated the script. I chucked it and started a new one, which I also threw in the trash. That happened four times with four radically different versions. After each version, I had a discussion with those friends. If there was a good scene in the first version, I included it in the second, and so on. The script was constructed this way, scene by scene. According to the case, I had this person or that person read it. Coppola read three versions, while the friends I invited to England to polish up the dialogue saw only the final version. Let's say it was the directors from San Francisco in particular, Coppola and Phil Kaufman, who followed everything, the ones I went to school with."
Here, the writing method Lucas had slowly cultivated is made explicit. He had previously expressed that his attempts at getting others to write the scripts for his films were so laborious that he finally gave up and just did it himself for Star Wars. But this is a gross simplification. As the above interview sums up clearly, the process maintained a highly collaborative nature. Lucas would act as the overseer, bouncing the script around to a myriad of editors and co-writers to help steer and shape it, with Lucas himself acting as a filter to take these suggestions and then put them down on the page in a manner which suited his own tastes. On top of that, these efforts still did not render characters as fully as was needed, so the Hikes rewrote his final draft to give more convincing dialogue and characterization. The earliest treatments and screenplays were practically all George Lucas, and unsurprisingly, they are stilted, confusing, and not as convincing or emotionally moving, As the drafts went on, his friends and colleagues had more of an influence, steering characters and dialogue, and giving input as to what was working and what wasn't. And in the final draft, the script finally emerges as a dramatic and emotional thrill ride, given even fuller life by the cast and focus by the picture editing. The cover may have stated, written by George Lucas, but like any competent writer, he knew how to overcome the limitations of his own talent.
"This film has been murder," Lucas groaned in the making of Star Wars. "Graffiti I wrote in 3 weeks. This one took me 3 years. Graffiti was just my life, and I wrote it down, but this I didn't know anything about. I had a lot of vague concepts, but I didn't really know where to go with it, and I've never fully resolved it. It's very hard stumbling across the desert, picking up rocks, not knowing what I'm looking for, and knowing the rock that I've got is not the rock I'm looking for. I kept simplifying it, and I kept having people read it, and I kept trying to get a more cohesive story."
He then adds, "But I'm still not happy with the script. I never have been."
Nonetheless, production was beginning, and whatever it is he had, it was the film. Star Wars had been born. Chapter 4. Purgatory and Beyond. Though Lucas initially began the project with the thought of doing a mere singular film as an homage to Flash Gordon, as he slowly carved out his own unique storyline and universe, the notion of sequels began to appear. The second draft from early 1975 is the first sign of potential evidence. It is labeled as Episode 1 and ends with a teaser text roll-up for another adventure. Though it can be argued that this was primarily a narrative device to evoke the serials and not necessarily evidence of a genuine plan to sequelize, Lucas had in fact taken this device into the realm of reality and begun to impose the idea that he could explore more stories in the galaxy he had created. This was not just idle daydreaming. When contracts were first negotiated for the film just prior to this draft, Lucas insisted on sequel rights for himself and later made agreements with the actors as well, in this case the two leads of Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher. In total, he had 3 contractual films. Like the Flash Gordon series that endured for chapter after chapter, Lucas had in mind the possibility of continuing adventures in his galaxy, but it seems as though he didn't have many specifics, but rather the concept itself of continuing the adventure. With his first stipulations for sequels occurring so far back, they are effectively divorced from the storyline of the final film, thus revealing the primary attraction being the idea itself. But by 1976, certainly there were many specific avenues now available to Lucas. The love triangle between Han, Luke, and Leia. Luke's continuing Jedi training, initially by Ben, but since he had rewritten him to die, he needed to invent a new teacher. The Rebels' continued battle against the Imperials. Darth Vader's revenge. Father Skywalker and Kenobi's past. The mysterious Emperor. And those were just existing story threads. The possibilities were potentially endless. Although Lucas states that he only thought about doing sequels after the film became a hit, he also mentions that he had sketched out a vague arc for Luke to go through in sequels as Luke is trained and becomes a Jedi Master. Lucas couldn't help but project where the story might progress, even if there was a good chance that none of this would ever see the light of day.
"By the time I finished with the first Star Wars, the basic ideas and plots for Empire and Jedi were also done."
Lucas said around the same time that he had collected his background notes into a pre-history outline, circa Draft 3 and 4, that he had also begun thinking about these very sequel threads mentioned previously, and had developed a very vague arc for Luke through the contractual duo of sequels. The Rebels have established a new base to continue their fight against the Empire, while Luke begins training as a Jedi and falls in love with Leia, finally culminating in the epic clash between hero and villain and the Rebels and Empire. This plan, though thin, is given credence by Lucas's admission that he had to invent Yoda unexpectedly,
since that role was originally intended for Kenobi, but Kenobi had been killed off in the first film, when it was thought that Lucas might never get a chance to make subsequent entries. With an actor's contract that stipulated two more films for Luke and Leia, and the rights for those films obtained at the expense of a pay cut, it is unsurprising that Lucas had at least pondered where he would ultimately take the story. Having sequels meant needing conflict, and though the Empire could still be around, it needed specific personalities. Darth Vader's survival of Star Wars emulated the serial episodes where the villain always escapes at the end to fight another day. Lucas described this Draft 3 development in 1975 as,
"Vader runs off in the end shaking his fist, I'll get you yet."
But it also served the practical purpose of providing the threat for the next film. In the third draft outline, Luke confronts Vader face to face in a lightsaber duel and kills him. But when Lucas cut this scene out, due to pacing reasons, he states, he had Vader survive the space battle so this scene could be used in the sequel, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which did indeed reprise this. With Luke's arc complete by the picture's end, Lucas would essentially reconfigure the original film into a trilogy, remaking the arc of that film as a three-part series, wherein each act of Star Wars can be seen as extended as its own film. Star Wars, being the first film in the trilogy, would represent Act 1, showing Luke's initiation into the larger galaxy and introducing all the characters, essentially the Tatooine section of the film. The second film would represent the second act of the original film, developing the content further, having Kenobi train Luke in the Jedi ways, here taking Luke's training on board the Millennium Falcon and remaking it as its own dedicated arc, and culminating with Luke facing his first trials. In Star Wars, it had been the Death Star rescue, but for the sequel, it would build on the development of the first film's ending. Luke would have to confront his nemesis, Darth Vader, face to face. The outcome of this confrontation would be a draw, but Luke would come out of the experience now as a full adult and Jedi Knight. The third film would be the resolution and triumph. In Star Wars, Luke was put through trials on board the Death Star, transforming him into a hero. But he then had to take his newfound skills and return to the enemy to destroy it, in that case, obliterating the Death Star, which the original film had implied would lead to the fall of the Empire itself. This third act would then be remade as its own film. After his first trial and confrontation with the Black Knight, Luke had to return, now a full Jedi, and finally slay Darth Vader, which would parallel the final fall of the Empire. Of course, working within the same budgetary confines of the first film, or perhaps less, these films would not contain the scope and scale that the mega-budget sequels of Empire and Jedi would contain. Splinter of the Mind's Eye provides us with a more modest, medium-scale sequel, which we will explore in a few moments.
"I know I've got a better one in me, one that is more refined," Lucas said of sequels in late 1976. Gene Roddenberry wrote about his Star Trek series and pointed out that it wasn't really until about the 10th or 15th episode that they finally got things pulled together. You have to walk around the world you've created a little bit before you can begin to know what to do in it.
These sequels, however, were not yet concrete commitments. Star Wars was designed to be a single film. And though he had ideas for additional stories, these were, at this time, to be done only as novels, as he outlined to Alan Dean Foster in a late 1975 meeting, describing the two sequel books the author was to write. However, as we will later learn, he kept the option of making them into films, though he would not make such a decision until after Star Wars was a hit. Thus, the Adventures of Luke Skywalker trilogy remained only as an interesting possibility, and that is an important factor to recognize. In 1974 and 1975, Lucas had taken steps to enable the possibility of sequels, but by the time the film was actually shot in 1976, many of these dreams had begun to fade. The 1976 fourth draft, in contrast to the second and third drafts from 1975, is notable for undergoing changes that make the film more satisfying as a standalone adventure. The main change is that, unlike the previous draft, the revised fourth draft sets up that destroying the Death Star will topple the Empire. A new scene appears on the Death Star, where Tarkin announces that the Senate has been dissolved. An officer protests that without the public illusion of bureaucracy, the Empire will not be able to maintain control. Tarkin replies that the Senate is no longer needed, now that the Death Star is around. If a system were to misbehave, it would simply be obliterated.
Fear will keep the local systems in line. Fear of this battle station.
Thus, when the Death Star was destroyed, the infrastructure of the Empire collapsed, and freedom was restored to the galaxy. The film had also slowly drifted away from sci-fi serialism and more into the realm of a fable, as the "A Long Time Ago" tagline now opens the film, giving it a more self-contained vibe. Luke also completed his arc. He left home, stepped into a larger world, became a hero, and at the end of the fourth draft, Ben Kenobi announces to Luke that he is now a Jedi Knight.
"You have stepped into your father's shoes,"
he says when Luke returns from the triumphant Death Star assault. The film now ends on a note that everyone lives happily ever after, and that the story is finished. Taking this further, Lucas then killed Kenobi off in the fourth draft revision, believing it would work best for the dramatic arc of the film as a standalone tale. These changes were probably the response to the enormous difficulties Lucas was encountering with the film at that time, including aggravation in getting a green light, which did not occur until December 1975, the threat of Fox pulling the plug on the entire production, logistical trouble in the impending production, budget issues, further tensions with Fox, and the realization that Star Wars had little support and would probably not be very successful. As Rinsler describes, Lucas was forced to rethink the script for the fourth draft in more practical terms related to the production, which was not going very smoothly. Though Lucas still retained tentative measures for an Adventures of Luke Skywalker trilogy, and would at the very least make them as novels, he protected himself by approaching Star Wars with the pragmatic understanding that it might be all that moviegoers ever saw, and there was always the possibility that he simply wouldn't feel like making sequels, preferring to move on to other projects. If he was unable or decided not to pursue any other material in the Star Wars galaxy, the film was a self-contained fable that didn't need any elaboration. Numbers and letters. It may be appropriate now to discuss a final related issue, which is the whole episode dilemma. Lucas claims that he always wanted to have the episode subtitle, but that the studio thought better of it because it would be too confusing. After the sequel came out, the episode subtitle suddenly made more sense, and it was reinstated. This story seems believable, although Rinsler's exhaustive Making of Star Wars conspicuously has no documentation that this occurred, and no early draft title crawl ever carried an episode listing. But after all, Lucas clearly had the concept of more chapters in mind, and the whole episode structure is straight out of the serial films. The question then is this: what episode was Star Wars originally supposed to be? At the time it was made, Lucas had spent all of his time developing the world of the Rebels and the Empire. The backstory enriched the current one, but it was still very vague, a set of mere notes. As Lucas has said on more than one occasion,
"The backstory wasn't meant to be a movie."
All of this information existed, pretty much in similar form, in the previous drafts. Draft 2 had a similar backstory, minus Father Skywalker's murder, and the basic plot was the same. Yet, it was titled as Episode 1. Further reinforcing this, when Lucas finally began work on the sequel in 1977, he initially titled it as Chapter 2. And the draft which he himself wrote was titled Episode 2, as we will later see. Indeed, the shooting script was titled "The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Wills, by George Lucas. Saga 1, Star Wars." Revised Fourth Draft, March 15, 1976. Lucasfilm Limited, 20th Century Fox. A previous draft of the script was labeled as Episode 1. Now it changed in the fourth draft to Saga 1. Star Wars was to be the first film in the series. The series of Luke, as it was called The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, which was then changed to The Adventures of Luke Skywalker after Lucas altered the protagonist's name during shooting. The backstory was in place at this point, but like any well-developed story, it was not part of the actual plot. It was simply what it was. Backstory. Like the serials that inspired it, Star Wars would begin in the thick of the action, with all sorts of events already having transpired that would never be seen, and that the viewers would fill in with their imagination. In fact, this was part of the intrigue and allure of the film. This literary device is known as in media res, in the middle of things. It increases audience interest by not revealing how things got to be where they are at the outset of the story, or bogging the film down in exposition. Like THX, it was also an inspiration taken from a Westerner's perspective of Japanese films. Lucas explained to Charlie Rose in a 2004 interview,
"I'd like to use, as a vehicle for Star Wars, Saturday matinee serials, which were these really high-powered action adventures that existed for 15 minutes. Each Saturday they'd show a different one, and if you missed one, you just sort of picked it up. So you never really saw, unless you were a really avid moviegoer, you never saw the whole thing. You only saw parts of it. And so it was designed to be like that. You know, you're in the middle of the thing, and that would be the end of it. It was one movie, it just grew to be three movies, unfortunately, because I wrote more than I expected."
While on the topic of titles, it is also interesting to note that the immortal title itself, The Star Wars, or simply Star Wars as it eventually became, at one time stood poised to be changed. Lucas said in 1980 that he actually came up with the title before any plot was developed.
"When I made the deal, I had to give it a name,"
he said of the 1971 United Artists Development Agreement. Lucas commented further in 1979's The Movie Brats.
"The title Star Wars was an insurance policy. The studio didn't see it that way. They thought science fiction was a very bad genre, that women didn't like it, although they did no market research on that until after the film was finished. But we calculated that there are something like $8 million worth of science fiction freaks in the USA, and they will go see absolutely anything with a title like Star Wars."
Mark Hamill also remembered an amusing anecdote in an interview from 2004.
Fox didn't want to have wars in the title. Executives said their research shows that women between the ages of 18 and 36 do not like films with the word wars in the title. I'm not making this up. This was a real memo. So we had a contest naming the movie, and we put it up on the call sheet. Anybody that can come up with a better title than Star Wars, if their title was selected, they'd win something. I forget what it was. And nobody came up with anything any better. The aftermath. By late 1975, with the completion of the third draft, Fox still hadn't officially greenlit Star Wars, but Lucas had learned a good lesson from Coppola. If the studio didn't commit, then force them to. Lucas began storyboards, hired art department crew, secured his entire cast as well as sound stages in England, and founded Industrial Light and Magic, all with his own money. American Graffiti had given him enough profit to push on without Fox's approval, even when the studio threatened to stop pre-production in light of renegotiating the budget, which was on its way to becoming one of the more expensive pictures of its day. "We decided to go ahead with the picture, whether they financed it or not," Kurt said. "It forced them to make some quick decisions."
Were it not for Lucas's personal investment, the film would have undoubtedly stalled out before Fox greenlit it. On March 22, 1976, cameras rolled in Tunisia as Star Wars began production. The shoot is legendary for its difficulty, and has been documented in a plethora of other sources. Lucas reflected on the root of the difficulty in a 1977 interview with Rolling Stone.
I struggled through this movie. I had a terrible time. It was very unpleasant. American Graffiti was unpleasant because of the fact that there was no money, no time, and I was compromising myself to death. But I could rationalize it because of the fact that, well, it is just a $700,000 picture. It's Roger Corman, and what do you expect? You can't expect everything to be right for making a little cheesy, low-budget movie. But this was a big, expensive movie, and the money was getting wasted, and things weren't coming out right. I was running the corporation. I wasn't making movies like I'm used to doing. American Graffiti had like 40 people on the payroll. That counts everybody but the cast. I think THX had about the same. You can control a situation like that. On Star Wars, we had over 950 people working for us, and I would tell a department head, and he would tell another assistant department head, and he'd tell some guy, and by the time it got down the line, it was not there. I spent all my time yelling and screaming at people, and I have never had to do that before.
With the film finally completed, Lucas was sure it would be a disaster. In his mind, it already was. Robots that never worked, sets that were too small, rubber masks that were laughable, his inability to emotionally connect to strangers or properly articulate his vision, a foreign crew that was at times hostile to him, homesickness, and special effects that were too limited, coupled with a hard time in the editing room, convinced Lucas that the film was a strange and bizarre failure.
I also wasn't happy with the lighting on the picture, Lucas said in a Rolling Stone interview.
Lucas had chosen the elderly Gil Taylor to shoot the film, whom had also shot Dr. Strangelove and Hard Day's Night, two of Lucas's favorite films.
I'm a cameraman, and I like a slightly more extreme, eccentric style than I got in the movie. It was all right. It was a very difficult movie. There were big sets to light. It was a very big problem. The robots never worked. We faked the whole thing, and a lot of it was done editorially.
The rough cut of the film was also a disaster, as scenes dragged on endlessly, and a more traditional approach to cutting robbed the film of its kinetic energy. Editor John Jimpson was fired, and Marcia took over, starting over from scratch and salvaging the film as best she could, shaping it into a more exciting and emotional experience. By Christmas, Marcia was still recutting the picture, and as she was reworking the Death Star trench run, Martin Scorsese called her up. His editor of New York, New York had died, and he desperately needed her help. She departed for L.A., tired of Star Wars, and eager to work on something more artistic and that wasn't being made by her husband. For George, the whole thing was that Marcia was going off to this den of iniquity, Willard Hike explained to author Peter Biskind. Marty was wild, and he took a lot of drugs, and he stayed up all night, had lots of girlfriends. George was a family homebody. He couldn't believe the stories that Marcia told him. George would fume because Marcia was running with these people. She loved being with Marty. In late spring, Star Wars was screened for studio executives and Lucas's friends. When the house lights came up, there was no applause, and Marcia burst into tears. "It's the at long last love of science fiction," she cried. "It's awful." Gloria Katz took her aside. "Shh, Laddie's watching," she hushed. Marcia just looked cheery. Among those in attendance that night were Steven Spielberg and Brian De Palma, the latter of whom viciously criticized and mocked Lucas when the group went out for dinner afterwards to discuss the picture. Spielberg, however, reassured Lucas that he had made a modern classic, which Lucas, of course, refused to believe. Paul Hirsch and Richard Chu had been brought in to finish the edit after Marcia left, but she returned for a week as the release date bore down upon George. As they scrambled to finish the picture, Lucas was sure he had produced a uniquely strange flop. Realistically speaking, Star Wars would likely make back its budget. Science fiction films at least had some kind of pre-existing fan base, but it didn't seem poised for any huge success. Dreaming of sequels, Lucas had Lucasfilm hold on to most of the props, costumes, sets, and models from Star Wars so that they could be reused for inexpensive follow-ups and costs cut down. If he fought hard, Lucas might be lucky enough to get a green light on his sequels, but with budgets of the same size or smaller. It would be nice if he could have the budget to do some of the grander things he had envisioned in some of the earlier drafts, Wookiee forest battles, for instance. But crafting a medium-budget space adventure seemed to be the only option. Fortunately, he already had another adventure to send Luke and company on. With so many ideas left over from the previous drafts, he had a wealth of ready-made concepts. One of them, which had survived all the drafts but the final, was the Kyber crystal. Perhaps a good adventure would be one involving that. Lucas began developing a new and exciting story, using his Raiders of the Lost Ark plot as the base. Luke is on an adventurous treasure hunt through an alien jungle world for the Kyber crystal, racing against Darth Vader for possession of the artifact, and battling with the evil Imperial forces. Lucas had been developing this kind of adventure for some time by 1977, having already outlined Raiders 2 years earlier, with Nazis in place of the Imperials, and the Ark of the Covenant in place of the Kyber crystal. The adventure would have Luke and Leia crash landing on a mysterious jungle world and discovering stormtroopers and Imperials carrying out a secret mining operation. There is a mix-up with the miners, a sneaky Imperial, capture, imprisonment, a rescue, and a wild adventure ride through the jungles in search of the elusive crystal. The story climaxes when Luke and Leia encounter Darth Vader himself, just as they find the crystal. Luke is injured by falling stones, but Leia battles Vader in a lightsaber match, being badly injured and leaving Luke to finally duel him and send Darth falling down a bottomless well while the heroes escape with the artifact. Alan Dean Foster had been hired to write the novelization of Star Wars, though the book gave credit to Lucas himself, and was in the process of developing this low-budget sequel into a novel as well, with the option of adapting it into a screenplay somewhere down the road. It would be titled Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and notated as being From the Further Adventures of Luke Skywalker, the second story in the Adventures of Luke Skywalker trilogy. Whether or not Lucas himself would direct it if it was ever made is up for debate. Perhaps he would act as executive producer, as he was on the eventual sequel, Empire Strikes Back. If Lucas decided not to make sequels and concentrate on other films, then Splinter would at least make for a marketable book tie-in, leading into the third and final chapter that Lucas planned on having Foster write. Foster recalled the process in a 2002 interview with Lou Tambone. "When George commissioned Splinter, he wanted me to write a story that could be filmed on a low budget. That's why, for example, everything takes place on a fog-shrouded planet. His idea was that if Star Wars didn't flop, wasn't a huge success, but maybe made a few bucks, he would have a story in hand that could be done using many of the props, costumes, etc. from the first film. It's the approach of a good engineer, who always includes a backup system in his design." The book was written and completed before Star Wars was released, hence it was always intended to appear as a book. Also, proceeding on the assumption that the film was a success, George didn't want any fans to have to sit around and wait for the next film. He wanted them to have additional Star Wars material available. Lucas did request a couple of changes to Splinter of the Mind's Eye. The main change involved the opening of the book. I had started out with an elaborate space battle. Bearing in mind his intention to keep open the option of filming Splinter on a low budget, George asked me to delete the sequence. As to other changes, they were all minor and few, and I can't recall them. Although in recent interviews, Foster has said that the majority of the story was actually invented by himself, the similarities to Raiders of the Lost Ark, which Lucas had been developing with Philip Kaufman since 1975, and especially other elements such as the Kyber crystal, very obviously a Lucas creation, suggests that Lucas may have had more influence than Foster remembers. A Foster interview from decades prior reveals that this is indeed the case, as he indicates that he and Lucas together hashed out the plot. We sat down to consciously design a book which could be filmable on a low budget, Foster said of his and Lucas's efforts. An even closer inspection of the plot is more revealing. It also contains many elements that Lucas would later put to use in the filmed sequel Empire Strikes Back, and uses elements that were cut out of the previous Star Wars drafts, much like the sequels would. Like Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader is given more power and action, and he kills a commanding Imperial officer for his failures. The story takes place on a swamp planet, which Luke crash lands and is stranded on, much like Dagobah, filled with lizards, overgrown vines, giant trees with twisting roots, thick fog, and a gloomy, foreboding ambience. And at one point, Luke is attacked by a swamp creature. A particular sequence recalls Luke's experience in the cave in Empire Strikes Back, where Luke wanders into a dark tunnel that turns out to be a partially man-made entranceway, much like the cave in Empire appears to be. Inside lurks a phosphorus ethereal creature, described as a spirit, that Luke must finally confront and slay with his lightsaber, similar to the film in which the Vader apparition symbolized Luke facing his fear. One character has his arm destroyed, but it is medically reconstructed in a scene which has overtones of Luke's reconstruction at the end of Empire. Luke and Vader finally meet in a lightsaber duel at the climax as well, and Vader uses the Force to throw objects, large stones, at Luke, who bats them off with his saber but is slowly overwhelmed. Vader also faces Leia at first, using one hand as he does against Luke in Empire, and taunts her, trying to provoke her anger. Vader also throws an energy bolt from his hands, much like the lightning from fighting devil dogs and the Emperor in Return of the Jedi. Finally, the story contains explicit, undeniable references to the 1973 synopsis and the 1974 rough draft. In those stories, General Skywalker in the synopsis and Anakin Starkiller in the rough draft find themselves on a jungle world and are captured by giant furry native aliens, Wookiees. The leader challenges him to a spear fight, and Skywalker Starkiller is able to prevail over the warrior, impressing the natives, and they accept him into their society and help him fight back against the Imperial outposts on their world. Skywalker Starkiller begins training them, and they are ultimately victorious. In Splinter, an identical sequence takes place. Imperials are carrying out operations in an outpost on planet Mimban, and Luke is captured by a group of native aliens. The leader challenges Luke to a fight, but Luke is able to beat him, and the natives accept him into their society. They agree to help him fight back against the Imperial outpost, and with Luke's training, they are able to prevail, much to the bafflement of the Imperials. Lucas would eventually put this concept to use in Return of the Jedi. The story of Splinter of the Mind's Eye was very much in the same vein as Star Wars, with humor, adventure, and a quick-moving, action-packed plot with many throwbacks to the adventure serials which the original film was based off. Harrison Ford had not signed a contract for any sequels, which is why Han Solo is mysteriously absent from the story, nor had Alec Guinness. Luke and Leia are obviously in love with each other, and their sexual tension is a major part of their adventure together. Darth Vader perhaps was now decided to be cybernetic, and so Lucas had a chance to imply as much with a scene where Vader's arm is cut off, and Luke is surprised that hardly any blood comes out. Vader simply pries his saber from his severed arm and begins attacking with his remaining one. Although it is still kept ambiguous, it strongly implies that Vader is not completely natural. The book was eventually released in February of 1978. An early meeting between Lucas and Foster in late December 1975 revealed Lucas's first thoughts on the sequels and the contractual trilogy, at this time conceived only as novels.
"I want to have Luke kiss the princess in the second book. The second book will be Gone with the Wind in Outer Space. She likes Luke, but Han is Clark Gable. Well, she may appear to get Luke because in the end, I want Han to leave. Han splits at the end of the second book, and we learn who Darth Vader is. In the third book, I want the story to be just the soap opera of the Skywalker family, which ends with the destruction of the Empire. Then someday I want to do the backstory of Kenobi as a young man, a story of the Jedi and how the Emperor eventually takes over and turns the whole thing from a republic into an empire, and tricks all the Jedi and kills them. The whole battle where Luke's father gets killed. That would be impossible to do, but it's great to dream about."
Of course, much had changed by 1977. Harrison Ford was not prepared to appear in sequels, so Han was written out of Book Two, with Luke and Leia having more of a straightforward romance. Vader's past, hinted at being explored in Book Two, was then moved into Star Wars itself. In December 1975, when Lucas made the above statement, we do not find out in the film that he was in fact the murderer of Luke's father. Lucas had planned for Luke and Darth to face each other with lightsabers in Star Wars, in the third draft outline, but when he couldn't fit this into the film, he saved it for the sequel. 3 months after this conversation with Foster, however, sensing the precariousness with which the film hung, Lucas moved the background information about Vader into the film itself. As Kenobi finally reveals to Luke in the March 1976 revised fourth draft that not only was his father a Jedi, but that he was killed by Vader. At the same time that Splinter of the Mind's Eye was being written, Lucas was touring science fiction and comic book conventions to raise awareness of Star Wars. Lucas insisted on developing a novel and comic adaptation, which were both released well before May 1977. As Lucas scrambled to finish the post-production and Alan Dean Foster wrote the sequel novel, a small but steady buzz began to build about the film. Dreamland. Before Splinter of the Mind's Eye was ready to be released, however, the unthinkable happened. May 25th turned over on the calendar, and a science fiction film that had developed quite a bit of word of mouth about it was debuting that night in the few select theaters in which it had been booked. On that auspicious date, Star Wars was released, and to the surprise of everyone involved, became a hit. And not just a hit, a smash hit. Taking $54 million in just the first 8 weeks, even the soundtrack was certified gold. Audiences around the world fell in love with Lucas's simple yet magical fairy tale of a youth becoming a hero amidst an operatic fantasy backdrop. Children, adults, people of every age, gender, and ethnic background all found a common love of Lucas's unlikely film. Lucas remembered his experience of May 25, 1977, in an article from Starlog.
"I was mixing sound on foreign versions of the film the day it opened here. I had been working so hard that, truthfully, I forgot the film was being released that day. My wife was mixing New York, New York at night at the same place we were mixing during the day. So at 6 o'clock, she came in for the night shift just as I was leaving on the day shift. So we ran off across the street from the Chinese theater, and there was a huge line around the block. I said, 'What's that?' I had forgotten completely, and I really couldn't believe it. But I had planned a vacation as soon as I finished, and I'm glad I did, because I really didn't want to be around for all the craziness that happened after that."
Soon after the film opened, Jay Cox was at director Jeremy Kagan's house. An exasperated Harrison Ford arrived, completely disheveled, his shirt half ripped off. "Jesus, Harrison, what happened?" Cox asked.
"I went into Tower Records to buy an album and these people jumped on me."
Word of mouth spread like wildfire, and its box office numbers climbed quicker than Fox executives could keep track of. Show after show was selling out, and there were permanent lineups around city blocks. Thousands of miles from the chaos of movie theaters, Lucas lay on a beach in Hawaii with Marcia, a well-earned break from the stress of their work. Alan Ladd Jr. would call up every night and report the climbing box office figures to Lucas, who could only listen in stunned silence. Steven Spielberg and his wife Amy joined George and Marcia, bringing news that Star Wars was in all the papers and on television shows. Building a sandcastle on the beach together, Spielberg remarked that he'd like to do a James Bond film one day, a real action-packed thrill ride. Lucas offered him an even better idea, his Raiders of the Lost Ark project that was in temporary hibernation. As George and Marcia spent the rest of their vacation on the island of Maui, they started wondering how they would spend the millions of dollars that would be coming their way. But all Lucas could find was a frozen yogurt stand.
"You know, these yogurt things are really going to take off. Maybe I'll buy a yogurt franchise," he said.
Perhaps it is here, as Lucas started thinking of ways to spend his wealth, that an ambition began forming which would later consume his life.
"Before Star Wars, I was going to restore the building we're in, which was sort of run down," Lucas remembered. "Then, when the film was such a success, I realized we could do this the way the original dream was, which was the dream for American zoetrope."
By the first week of June, Star Wars had practically made back its budget. When George and Marcia returned to San Francisco a few days later, they were returning to a world that would never be the same for them again. As its popularity gained momentum like a cinematic avalanche, the film became the event of the summer, and Star Wars was a success beyond anyone's wildest dreams and expectations. Audiences were thrilled and touched by the warm characters and unprecedented kinetic graphics. A grand and glorious film that may well be the smash hit of 1977, and certainly is the best movie of the year so far, wrote Time magazine. Star Wars is a combination of Flash Gordon, The Wizard of Oz, the Errol Flynn swashbucklers of the 30s and 40s, and almost every Western ever screened. The result is a remarkable confection, a subliminal history of the movies, wrapped in a riveting tale of suspense and adventure, ornamented with some of the most ingenious special effects ever contrived for film. It has no message, no sex, and only the merest dollop of bloodshed here and there. It's aimed at kids, the kid in everybody. Roger Ebert praised, "Every once in a while, I have what I think of as an out-of-the-body experience at a movie," and went on to state, "The characters in Star Wars are so strongly and simply drawn, and have so many small foibles and large, futile hopes for us to identify with. The movie's heart is in its endearingly human and non-human people." The LA Times raved, "Star Wars is Buck Rogers with a doctoral degree, but not a trace of neuroticism or cynicism, a slam-bang, rip-roaring gallop through a distantly future world full of exotic vocabularies, creatures, and customs, existing cheek by cowl with the boy and girl next door." Variety claimed it a magnificent film, stating, "Like a breath of fresh air, Star Wars sweeps away the cynicism that has in recent years obscured the concepts of valor, dedication, and honor. Make no mistake, this is by no means a children's film, with all the derogatory overtones that go with that description. This is instead a superior example of what only the screen can achieve." "When I saw Star Wars in its finished form," Francis Coppola remembers, "and saw the complete tapestry George had done, it was very compelling, and it was really a thrill for the audience." Tom Pollock, the prototype of the cynical Hollywood attorney, remembered with an amazement that still seems vivid his first viewing of the film. "The experience is not like any experience I have had since I was a child. It's reliving the first time you see a certain kind of movie when you're 8 or 9 years old. You feel you can never get it back again, but seeing Star Wars is getting it back." Saul Zance, producer of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, took out a page in Variety with an open letter to George Lucas and all who participated in the creation of Star Wars. "You have given birth to a perfect film, and the whole world will rejoice with you. Lucy Wilson, Lucas's assistant, remembers, "You'd go to restaurants and people were sitting around you talking about the person you work for and the movie you were working on, and it's on the cover of magazines." Most amusingly, Harrison Ford retracted his infamous statement on the script after seeing the wonderful heart the completed picture exuberated with. "I told George, you can't say that stuff, you can only type it. But I was wrong. It worked." The film was an out-of-control phenomenon, like a cinema version of Beatlemania. Everyone involved in the film became celebrities, and kids would ask ILM model makers for autographs, while the stars of the film could hardly venture outdoors without being mobbed in the streets. At work, adults excitedly talked about the film around the water cooler, while at the playground, kids excitedly talked about the film around the jungle gym. It was an unprecedented feat in the entertainment business. Lucas's plans were thrown for an unexpected loop. Already, fans in the press were beginning to ask about a sequel. It was obvious from the film's ending that there could be one. What happens next? That was the million-dollar question that only Lucas could answer.
"At first, I was contemplating selling the whole thing to Fox to do whatever they wanted with it," Lucas told Alan Arnold in 1979. "I'd just take my percentage and go home and never think about Star Wars again. But the truth of it is, I got captivated by the thing. It's in me now."
George and I didn't actually make the decision to go ahead with the second movie until a month after Star Wars was released, Gary Kurtz remembered in a Starlog interview. "Neither of us was positive about how people would react to the first film, but after a month, we knew that interest was high enough to go with a sequel." With the success of Star Wars, Lucas no longer had to restrain himself with budgetary demands. His low-budget sequel was shelved, Book 3 was canceled, and he began thinking of new, more extravagant stories, the kinds he wanted to put in the film in the first place. He also saw a means to an end. With personal ownership of sequels to what was on its way to becoming one of the biggest hits of the decade, Lucas could turn his trilogy into a franchise that he could use to fund a dream of his, a private retreat where filmmakers could come to research and develop movies together. His Parkhouse office was one thing, but this would be something far bigger. Taking inspiration from Coppola's decisions, Lucas would finance Star Wars II himself and maintain complete control over the film and greater financial profit points. His rights to any Star Wars sequels would expire if he didn't start making one of them within 2 years, and so work would begin on the film just over 6 months after the release of Star Wars. Producer Gary Kurtz remembered some sequel plans immediately following Star Wars in this 1999 interview with IGN FilmForce. "At the very tail end of the shooting of Star Wars, when Laddie had seen more of the footage, they started to come back with saying, well, how much would it be to just maybe save these sets or shoot part of another movie and make a sequel which could be done kind of on the cheap? And we said there was no way we could do that, because we didn't have a script, and there was no time to write a script. And anyway, it would probably be quite different. And if they wanted a sequel, we had to do it properly. The idea kind of faded away at that time, because we were just interested in getting the film made. When it opened, and it was quite popular, the idea of doing a sequel came back. So immediately the idea was, all right, let's sit down, find a writer, and do a proper job on this treatment material and odd notes and things that we already had extracted from the first time around. Because George originally wrote a lot of different, well, you've probably read some of the different versions of the screenplay. The story shifted back and forth a great deal. So doing a sequel was fairly easy to structure out, and then it became clear that Fox wanted it right away. But we kept a lot of props, some set pieces and things, design things, around the idea of being able to use them for two films." As Lucas was contemplating Star Wars II, Star Wars was the most popular event of the summer, and no character was more loved than Darth Vader. He was the first instance of such an iconic villain,
personifying evil and villainy in a universal way, while also providing crowd-pleasing scenes. He was the villain the world loved to hate. Although